everybody. Dave Consolazio alongside Sam Saig for episode 9 of Running the Option. Sam, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm a little confused, though. I mean, I want to say the national championship is on Monday, January the 9th at the Superdome in New Orleans, but based on the buzz this week, maybe it's actually in Tuscaloosa at Bryant-Denny Stadium Saturday night. Can you help me?
Hard to argue against that. We'll get to that in an entire show worth of a segment. We generally do about 4 segments on the show here. First, I want to talk a little bit about last week because it was such a great week of college football. And then segment 2/... Episode 9 of Running the Option, we're just going to do Alabama-LSU. We will beat it to death as much as we possibly can, because there's not enough media on this game, is there? I can't seem to find any. I go online, I go on the TV, I can't find any media on this game, so we need to beat it to death, too.
We've got you covered. I know you haven't heard it, but we'll get the whole matchup covered.
We will run the option, don't you worry about a thing. If you have a college football podcast, I think you have to talk about that game. You'll have to forgive us if you've heard enough about that game. But let's talk about last week first. So much happened, okay? Let's start with Case Keenum, Thursday night, 73-34 over Rice, 534 passing yards, 9 passing touchdowns, becomes the all-time passing touchdown leader with 139. Graham Harrell had 135. Crazy thing about Case Keenum, he's not even close to done yet. Obviously, they have 4 more regular season games, Houston does. Then they have the Conference USA Championship game. And then, of course, they probably have a bowl game as well. Or they do have a bowl game coming up. So that's 6 more games for Case Keenum. Figure about 4 touchdowns a game, he could tack on another 20-plus. Incredible how much he'll beat this record by 10.
Yeah, and a great story after the injury, because for him to be in this situation that we all knew was very likely to happen, but for it to happen and for him to do it in that kind of a monster game with 73 points, it's just a great story. And even though it's Conference USA, and we talk about how fun that conference is, but it's just great to see that this career is going to be capped off with this much of a legacy left behind.
Without question, one of the great college quarterbacks of all time, and the greatest coach of all time, hard to argue against, Joe Paterno gets win number 409, passes Eddie Robinson for the most wins in Division I history. Huge accomplishment for a Penn State team, the ugliest 8-1 team I've ever seen, but this is Penn State football. This is Joe Pa football.
It is, and again, when it comes to this year's Penn State team, at the end of the day, because of the way that they're winning, and if they do go on to somehow win that division, which seemed completely unlikely a few weeks ago, but they're in a position to do it, and who cares what the scores are? We've been pretty outspoken about not believing in this team, but they're 2 games in the lead right now in that division. So if they keep doing this, now their tests are still ahead, but can you imagine Joe Pa already having this record, well-deserved, but can you imagine him capping it off in a Big Ten championship setting? That would be even more remarkable.
Yeah, whether they won that one or not, they'd certainly be the underdog, but to see them in the Big Ten championship would be a fitting way to have your first Big Ten championship with the greatest coach of all time on the sideline. And then you have Oklahoma. We said Oklahoma would take care of business in that Kansas State game, but I don't think we quite saw the Kansas State Cinderella season coming to an end with a 58-17 loss.
I mean, we did pretty much nail that it was going to be an easy Oklahoma win even on the road. But no, I didn't expect a near 60-point outburst. What we can say is Big Game Bob, this is what he does, right? he comes off of a disappointing loss, easily rallies his troops for a road game against a jacked up and undefeated Kansas State squad, disposes of them easily, as he's done with teams in the past coming off
you
of
called
loss.
It last week, because I said, what if Oklahoma comes right out depressed about what had happened the week before? You said, no, look at his history, it never happened.
I mean, I wish I could be a fly on the wall of what their practices are like, because they always seem to play their best after one of those really mysterious losses. They had 690 yards against a pretty proud K-State defense, and that's just as irritating to me as it is impressive, given the fact that they got beat by an inferior opponent the week before at home. They end their 39-game winning streak at home. It's one of those things where this is what this team is capable of being against anyone, including one of those SEC teams, as far as being able to compete on any day with any team. team. And so here's what I will say, though. If you look at it, and this is kind of nuts to think about, but this is what happened in 2008. They had a similar, they had a loss to Texas. Then they started like blowing people out in record-setting fashion, and they got themselves right back in the national title picture and then into that game eventually. If you look at it, they're sixth in the BCS. If Stanford loses to Oregon and they take care of Oklahoma State, they could jump Boise and be right back in the picture.
It's a great point, and it's crazy to me that at the end of the first half, they kick a long field goal to take a six-point lead in the game, and they're jumping around, and they're genuinely happy and excited, and there just doesn't seem to be any carryover from the week before. No. There just didn't seem to be this, because when you saw Oregon lose to LSU, the week afterwards, they had the big win over a weak team, but after touchdowns, they just kind of seemed a little down, because they had, like you said in a past podcast, built that game up to be their whole season. Oklahoma, you don't see that. They just look like they're just loving life going out there and beating these teams. I don't get it, but like you said, maybe that fly in the wall, maybe you would have heard Stoops say, hey, we're still in this. As bad as that loss is, we're still in this. Look at what has been going on all over the place in college football. We could probably jump an undefeated Boise State. I mean, the pollsters don't love them, so who knows? And then we nailed that Nebraska game. I mean, you can't take anything away from Michigan State coming off of the two big wins that they had. But that said, I would have never in a million years thought Nebraska, with the way their defense has been playing this year, could hold anybody to three, let alone a Michigan State team that was rolling the way they were.
Yeah, I mean, that game, we thought there would be a letdown factor. It looked like a letdown game. It turned out to be, obviously, a huge letdown game. And Nebraska was all over it, because they were pitching it that way throughout the week. I mean, Bo Pelini hinted at it, hoped that Michigan State would come in with nothing left in terms of all their excitement was blown the previous 2 weeks. And they were just so ready and sitting almost on that game, and it went exactly how Nebraska fans would have dreamed it up.
And when you look at the opposite side of that big Michigan State upset, the Wisconsin Badgers, who go from arguably our favorite team of the bunch right behind LSU, Alabama, to an afterthought all of a sudden with another crazy loss last week.
This was a disappointment. I don't know how else to say it, because a lot's going to be made about how the Badgers lost the last 2 weeks on essentially Hail Mary plays with seconds left, and they're two plays away potentially from being number four in the BCS, let's say. The thing is, I look at this game, and I'm not sure I'm going to pin this one on one pass the way that we would the game against Michigan State, because if you look at it, the problem is Wisconsin's defense could not get a hold of Braxton Miller. They couldn't tackle him. He didn't have a particularly great day passing. 7 of 12, 89 yards and a touchdown. 40 of those yards and the touchdown came with 20 seconds left on that ridiculous bomb, that pass to win it. But the thing is, Wisconsin really didn't have an answer for stopping the run. This is a program that prides itself on running the ball and stopping the run. They couldn't stop the run. Braxton Miller ran for 99 yards and two touchdowns. Dan Heron ran for 160 yards. I'm going to look at that, and I'm going to look at something else. And that is, how in the world can Wisconsin, after giving up a game-changing blocked punt for a touchdown, not address special teams? They give up another blocked punt that leads to a score in this game. Their kickoff coverage was awful. I'm not going to look at that last play, even though Braxton Miller is the hero for Ohio State. And by the way, Ohio State's slowly becoming a pretty good story.
And Braxton Miller is becoming a star in the making. Yeah.
But what in the world is Wisconsin doing to let another special teams error, you know, blow that game a little bit for them?
And maybe that's where you do have to give a guy like Bob Stoops credit, because, you know, we talked last week about him not bringing this team to the next level, but it does say a lot about a coach that can get his players motivated for weeks after big losses, because this looked like a Wisconsin team to me that wasn't prepared for this Ohio State game, and they absolutely should have been. I mean, this Ohio State team with Braxton Miller at quarterback isn't a threat to pass the ball. Mm-hmm. They're just not, and if you go in with the mindset that we're going to stop the run, which, like you said, they should be capable of doing, it's what they're built to do, you should win this game, bounce back, and you should be right there in that conversation of teams that, hey, with all the things shaking out right, maybe they get back into the conversation. They're not going to now, and they're going to be a complete afterthought. All of a sudden, you know, at the end of the year when we're talking about top 10 teams, we're not even going to be talking about them anymore, which is crazy considering how dominant they were through the first half of the season.
Right, they're a full two games back of Penn State now in the leaders division. Now a lot is still to go, including those teams playing each other, but it's crazy that we can sit here and now discount and write off Wisconsin as far as the storylines that are major storylines in college football. Who would have thought they'd be an afterthought at this point?
Yeah, I wanted to see that Stanford-Wisconsin game play out in the Rose Bowl, assuming that one of those teams wasn't in the national championship, and now all of a sudden I don't even want to see that game. That would be a letdown for me to see Stanford going up against a Wisconsin team that's clearly beatable. How did that happen in 2 weeks? That's college football in a nutshell. Georgia tops Florida in the world's largest outdoor cocktail party. I just brought that game up strictly to say that again here on the podcast, but great come-from-behind victory for Georgia, and really continues to keep the race close between them and South Carolina.
That was the game that even when they were loaded in the past, when they had all the talent in the world, they couldn't get over the hump in a game against Florida. Now, Florida's obviously a lot more down, but winning that game psychologically does so much for the Georgia team, the coaching staff, and the fan base, that might actually be the start of the downhill kind of part of their schedule where they can start to really hone in on getting that SEC East one. I mean, you wouldn't have thought after especially the way against South Carolina it didn't go their way, but to be in this position now where, yeah, South Carolina has one loss and you still have to worry about them, but Georgia is in attack mode now after that game against Florida, feeling pretty good.
And while South Carolina's schedule is somewhat manageable, they have the tough one against Arkansas this week, and Georgia controls their own destiny if South Carolina loses one game, so could definitely happen. They could still top the East. Georgia Tech, I said that would be a tough game for Clemson. I didn't realize it would be that great of a game for Georgia Tech. You know, I had a feeling their offense would come around. It did. I said their defense might play well. It did. Had no idea that anybody could hold this year's Clemson team to 17.
You nailed it.
I occasionally get one right. Yeah. You know, you shoot enough fish in a barrel, you're bound to hit one, as I've said before. But you know, the thing about that game, because I was watching three games at once, and I had that one, fortunately, on ESPN3, so I had that up on the computer screen, and I'm watching that game. You know, the crazy thing about that game is it should have been worse for Clemson. Georgia Tech was knocking on the door. They were about to punch it in to go up 28. When Clemson jumps off sides to force a fumble, the offsides isn't called, the fumble stands. Clemson goes 95 yards for a touchdown, and then, wildly enough, Georgia Tech only up 14 and needing to just protect the lead, throws a careless interception. Clemson has the ball first and goal from the 9, and Taj Boyd turns around and throws an interception, and we were just talking last week about how he hasn't done that and how Clemson hasn't been Clemson. And on that play, Clemson was Clemson. People look at the final score and they see 31-17 Georgia Tech. They saw how the first half went. I think they just say, okay, Georgia Tech beat them. But if you were watching that game, if they make the play there, it's a 7-point game with about 9 minutes left. Clemson probably goes on to win that game. Yeah. So, and then that fumble play would have really come under scrutiny. But Georgia Tech gets away, and they deserved it. They played better on both sides of the ball.
Yeah, it was a wild sequence, that series of plays. And for me, this is the thing about Georgia Tech. I've obviously had a lot of words for them throughout the season, both high and low.
Yeah.
And low lately, obviously, given the last few weeks. But they really did get back to playing their brand of football this week with a brilliant performance on the ground. One of the most overanalyzed statistics, and now recently a lot of analysts are saying they're dismissing it as one of the most useless statistics in football, is time of possession. That's actually been thrown out a lot lately by people that are analysts.
That's a great point, because that's always been the standard for which team dominated the game, so to speak. If you have the time of possession battle won, that's supposed to mean you dominated.
Yeah, and the reason that statistic has been kind of diminished in its importance is because recently, with the quick strike nature of spread offenses, especially offenses like Oklahoma State and Oregon, Oregon's a great example.
Auburn last year,
these teams, and I think about Oregon a lot because they say this, is that they don't care about time of possession. They score 20 seconds at a time. They usually lose the time of possession and still win in blowout fashion. But in a game like this one, it shows how important time of possession can be, because Georgia Tech had a plan for how to attack Clemson, knowing that they were vulnerable in the run game, in the run defense. And they controlled the ball for nearly 40 minutes and absolutely tortured and frustrated a very impatient and antsy Clemson team, because Clemson on offense was sitting on that sideline just kind of waiting in a really nervous fashion. When are we going to get the ball? When are we going to get the ball? We're down by a few points. We need to score in a hurry. And that affected their rhythm on offense. That triple option is so diverse because it forces a defense to account for three different possibilities. Obviously, the fullback up the gut, the quarterback keeper, and then the pitch to the wide boundary. And Clemson was only prepared for two of those at a time. So they were really not equipped either personnel-wise or scheme-wise.
And this is what you loved about this offense so much when we were talking about how it was unstoppable. Right. So I don't understand what happened over the 3 weeks before this game where teams figured out those three attacks.
Well, and you pointed out that this series has not treated Clemson well. And clearly, this is just not, you know, Clemson, this is their kryptonite in the ACC. They cannot get over this game. Georgia Tech ran for 383 yards and controlled the clock all throughout it, which is exactly what Paul Johnson wanted.
That's what we saw in the, sorry to cut you off, but that's what we saw in the Syracuse-West Virginia game in that, you know, how do you stop a Dana Holgorsen offense? You keep them off the field, and sometimes that time of possession really is valuable.
And it was a perfect recipe for disaster because Clemson also turned the ball over. They had new running backs in for Andre Ellington who didn't play. They fumbled the ball, each of them, and Taj Boyd, like we said, he just wasn't his turnover-less self. He was turnover-prone this week, and that was a killer.
Speaking of turnover-prone, great timing on your part. Last week, you brought up Oklahoma State's defense, how they're a bend. They're not a bend, don't break defense. They're a bend, some more. Go Gumby, stretch Armstrong, bend, and then don't break. Right. And they force these turnovers. What in the bottom 10 teams in the league in total yards against, and then in the top in turnovers forced. Well, true to form last week, they give up 622 yards to Baylor, yet they forced 5 turnovers. They were up 42-0 in that game, and, you know, I had to say to myself, at some point, I have to start saying this Oklahoma State defense isn't a liability. Yeah. This is the way that they play, and they play it well. At some point, we have to stop saying this is a weakness for them, because it doesn't make sense statistically to me, but it's passing the eye test. We've gotten so far in the season now that I can't continue to say that this is a fluke, or can we?
Well, and like time of possession, in this case, it's a defensive stat that we can throw out for this team, and that's the yards, the total yards they give up, because like you said, who cares if you're giving up 622 yards? That's perfectly within their comfort zone now of how they've won games. If you put up nearly 60 points and get the ball turned over to your offense that many times, then you're in your comfort zone, and that's just how they play, you know, on a weekly basis. Will it catch up to them eventually against a team that doesn't turn it over? Like, imagine them playing a team like Alabama, who takes all of that away and really puts their will and their style into a game. I don't know, maybe it would eventually catch up to them then, but for now, that's what they like to do.
It's working, and it could get them that shot against Alabama or LSU, because they look like they can manage their schedule with the way they're playing. Lastly, the biggest game of the week, the incredible triple overtime Stanford-USC game. What were your thoughts? What did you take away from that game?
Well, my first initial thoughts on the game after the game, like not even talking about how great of a game it was and how amazing it was for college football in the Pac-12, but with the 56 points, Andrew Luck has now put up the most points on USC in their history twice in his career. He did it in 09 with 55 at the Coliseum and 56 in this game at the Coliseum. Now, obviously, it took 3 overtimes, but that, in the many amazing stats of Andrew Luck, to me, that's just as significant, because this is USC, one of the top 3 to 5 storied programs in college football history, with all of that amazing history in the Coliseum, and he does it twice to them in his career.
I don't know, you know, how the Heisman voting formula works, and it's not really a formula, it's just a bunch of guys with votes, they can vote how they want to, but finally, he's on the national stage. It's not one of those West Coast, nobody saw it games. Everybody was watching this game. And he's got the ball in a tie game late. And I'm thinking, finally, here's his Heisman moment. You know, he takes the lead and wins the game for Stanford. He throws the pick six. But I came away more impressed with the drive right after the pick six, because I heard from a lot of people, reporters and fans alike, that the Coliseum was the loudest it's been since USC's championship day, since their heyday. That stadium was going nuts, and credit to the fans who really bought into this team as essentially their bowl game. I mean, it was everything you could have hoped for a USC fan, other than the win, of course. But that pick six, the place was going insane. And if you had any doubts in your mind about Andrew Luck as the first overall pick, which not many did, but if you did, the complete composure on this kid's face. He's not a kid, he's a man. And it never fazed him. He just throws that ball, and I can name half of the quarterbacks in the NFL starters right now that in that same situation would have folded under the pressure. He just, like a complete professional, just said, sorry about that, guys. We're going to go tie it up. We're going to win it in overtime. And they did. Incredible.
Like any great player, he wanted the ball in his hands after the pick six. He wasn't gun-shy about it. Great players want the ball. They want those moments in that stadium with that crowd. The crowd probably even fueled him because he's that kind of player. I've never seen a pick six work so much in the favor of a Heisman Trophy candidate, but I think Kirk Herbstreit said the same thing. That pick six happening actually demonstrated his greatness even more because of how he followed it.
It defined him.
It really did. And you know, Stanford ran its winning streak to 16, but it was just about as difficult as you can make it because USC played one heck of a game, and it was great for the Pac-12 to have that type of game. I mean, I thought Matt Barkley matched Andrew Luck for a long time there because they had pretty much the same statistics. I mean, Barkley had 3 touchdowns and a pick. Luck had 3 touchdowns and a pick. And like Wisconsin, we wanted to see how Stanford would do in a game where there was adversity. They were in too many blowouts. I mean, they held their last 13 opponents to 21 points or fewer. What was it going to be like when they finally got tested? And they were in this game, and they came out on top. So, you know, you have to really credit them for that.
A huge win for them, a huge win for Andrew Luck, and a huge win for David Shaw, because he needed to be tested too, and credit him for the play calls down the stretch. I was a little confused on that 3rd and 9 when he takes the ball out of Andrew Luck's hands. But, you know, for all these creative geniuses, there's always a play or two every game that leaves you scratching your head, but it's easy from your couch at home to criticize these guys. But last thing before we move on to the big game about this game, you know, there was a lot of controversy. Lane Kiffin had a lot of things to say about the officiating in this game. And, of course, some fans are talking about how the Pac-12 wanted Stanford in there, so the game was fixed. What are your thoughts on all that nonsense?
I mean, I certainly wouldn't touch the fixed part of it, but the two plays, I mean, you look at the TJ McDonald play, and TJ McDonald, number 7 safety for USC, who kind of channels some of the Taylor Mays qualities that you've seen in the past out of that position. But he, I do believe, has gotten maybe an unfair label as being a dirty player over the course of this season by Pac-12 refs. And it might have come back to bite him in this game because there's no doubt that hit had excessive force. But when you really slow it down, and I think this is what Lane Kiffin wanted to say. He said, if I took TJ into the Pac-12 offices and sat down with all the refs and with Larry Scott and played that play, I would want them to tell me what could he have done different or what should he have done different. Because if you look at it and slow it down, and again, they happen so fast that you can't fault the refs either. But he led with his shoulder, if you look at it, and they said he might have launched himself, but his right foot and his feet were still on the ground. At the end of the day, it was such a hard hit. It was such a vicious hit that I think that's what drew the flag, just the force of it, especially since the receiver had dropped it. But it's such a split-second thing that you can see from Lane Kiffin and TJ McDonald's side, what was I supposed to do? I thought the guy caught the ball in that moment. I had to jar it out of there. You're taught to lead with your shoulder and have a huge hit, and that's what he did. It's a tough situation all the way around, but I think that might have been, you know, Pac-12 refs have been accused of kind of leading with reputation calls on some certain guys. This might have been one of those.
I could see that criticism, and both McDonald and Kiffin obviously have every reason to be upset. But at the same time, I've seen that called that way just about every time. I can't criticize the refs for making the call that they always seem to make. One of the reasons it might be a reputation call is because a lot of guys aren't capable of making that big of a hit. You know what I mean? Yeah. Maybe a guy that hits a little softer, it doesn't look as bad. But the point being, you know, when I saw it live, I thought it was a penalty. I'm sure the ref saw the same thing. And you're right. If you go in, you put that tape in, and you look at it structurally, you're probably going to have a tough time saying exactly what was wrong with it. But it was high, and it was hard. And whether you like it or not, in football today, that penalty is called. I mean, I don't think that was unfair treatment. Yeah. That's what football is today, and it's for like better or worse.
It's like umpires. You know, umpires have strike zones. They stick to them. And even if a call might be left or right of the zone, if the zone is the same every time, you have to learn to deal with that. These calls have been pretty similar across college football. If you go in that hard and up high, you just have to expect it.
And what did you think of the controversy at the end of the game with a second left? They were looking if he was out of bounds, yeah. And he was in bounds, and there was 1 second left, then there was the timeout call. What did you make of all that?
Well, again, you know, and Lane Kiffin obviously brought this up. So the protocol, obviously the referee gets to make the final judgment. The sideline judge in that game, evidently, according to Lane Kiffin, Robert Woods didn't get out of bounds. The play took longer than SC expected. It was meant to run 7 seconds, and it ran 9, obviously, or at least 8. And that wasn't supposed to happen. Robert Woods took the play outside. But the knee was down, if you look at the replay. And Lane Kiffin's point was, we know he didn't get out of bounds. That's not our argument. We think he was in bounds, and I immediately called timeout. And the sideline judge awarded me that timeout and said he'd go and talk about it. At the end of the day, when they met up the refs, they came back and the call went against USC. I think Lane Kiffin's concern was, why did you go into that meeting saying, I'm going to get that timeout for you, and you came out of it without the timeout? You know, so I think that's where he was coming from.
I mean, and I get this argument too, and it makes sense, and I believe he even said that he, before the play even started, said to that line judge, when the second the play ends, timeout, I got my timeout. And that's what he was arguing after the fact, you know, that they were making fun of him in the broadcast saying, you're not going to win this one, Lane, but he was saying, you know, I said as soon as the play is over, it's a timeout. Out. The line judge agreed with me, so why isn't it a timeout? The problem is, and you can blame Robert Woods for this, it's not necessarily all Lane Kiffin's fault, but if that was the idea, that it wasn't essential to get out of bounds, they had a timeout, he just has to fall down and with 4 seconds left, call a timeout, or 3 seconds, or 2 seconds, or whatever. If it was always designed to end in a timeout, don't leave it to chance like that, because it was a half second either way, and I don't know that you're, I mean, maybe you are, maybe you aren't, I guess it depends on the line judge or the head referee, but I don't know that you're allowed to call a timeout before the play actually ends. And so there's like a half second there where if you actually knee down and then he runs and calls timeout, he probably didn't get it in on time, so you leave it too much to chance.
And
I
think
opinion.
Lane Kiffin even admitted the play certainly took longer than it was designed to take. I mean, I don't know if Robert Woods freaked out and knew that, and so he wanted to get out of bounds, but it certainly wasn't designed to be that long. And in the end, they cut it way too close.
But regardless of where you land on the controversies, incredible game,
sure.
Big win for Stanford, and very, very strong game for USC to prove that they still have this type of game in them. Adds a little intrigue to that Oregon game.
And last thing on that, Zach Ertz, maybe the most well-rounded and best tight end Stanford has, it looks like he's going to be out for that game. So this three tight end mammoth formation that they run is going to need to be tweaked a little. They still have two of the best tight ends in the country, but with Ertz out, that could affect them against Oregon.
So that was last week, Sam. A ton of really interesting games we needed to discuss. This week, there's only one.
Just one, and the only one that maybe we'll think about at the end of this season, as good as these games have been. This has a chance to go down as one of those games that, you know, I think since 1943, there's been 22 number one versus number two games. Many of them have gone on as some of the greatest football games in college football history. You don't want to put that kind of expectation level on a game like this, because sometimes it disappoints, but it has a chance to be that type of game. And I think jumping into it, I like to think of these as two heavyweight fighters, so let's just go over the tail of the tape like you would in any boxing fight for a championship level.
Before you do, I just need to say that what adds even more interest to this game for me, you know, everybody had it circled since the beginning of the year when LSU beat Oregon the way they did, and obviously Alabama was rolling. You know, we knew that both these teams could be undefeated heading into this game. Since then, we've seen both teams dominant. Obviously, this game has had a hype machine built into it from the get-go. But I think it's interesting that 2 weeks ago, Michigan State and Wisconsin played the game of the year. And then last week, Stanford and USC won up that and played the game of the year. And they weren't surprises. We had those games pegged as big games, and they both lived up to not only their own hype, but exceeded it. And so now we have this game that's hyped even more than those two were, arguably combined, and the hype it has to live up to, I mean, what has to happen in this game for this game to live up to the hype?
I mean, I've heard 1,000 nicknames, Armageddon and Alabama, all these different names. I don't know what has to happen other than if these teams hit each other the way they've hit other teams, they're going to collide and you're going to see fire and sparks and
I think we will literally see, hell and brimstone out there. But yeah, let's go over the tail of the tape.
So let's just start with the obvious stuff. Alabama is the best defense in the country by the eye test, but also statistically. They are the number one ranked defense in the country. LSU doesn't trail far behind at fourth in the country currently in terms of total defense. Scoring defense, Bama is one, LSU is three. I mean, if you look at it, Alabama gives up 6.9 points a game. Ridiculous. LSU's at 11.5, still amazing. They both average 39 points, a little bit more a game. It's so negligible, the difference between these two teams across the board statistically, that if you look at it, I mean, the game is going to be won in such minuscule ways in terms of detail. Bama has allowed one 100-yard rusher in the last 55 games. That's a stat that stuck out to me. LSU has more interceptions on defense this season than passes completed on them over 15 yards. So if you try to go down the field 15 yards, you're more likely to get the ball intercepted than even if it just falls short or whatever. They really just don't give up yards, and they don't give up points. And if you look at it, the thing that sticks out to me is LSU's defensive front averages about 273 pounds per guy. Alabama has an offensive line that's about well over 300 per man. So I look at this, and the first thing that I want to know is, will LSU be able to overcome the power and the size for four quarters? We know they can overwhelm a spread speed offense like Oregon, but what will they do when a team lines up and tries to power it through you?
Well, before we try and answer that, I just want to stick with these statistics, because as negligible as they are, Alabama has the edge in every statistic. Yeah. And you can obviously write a little bit of that off because of the difference in schedules. Of course, LSU had to go against those Oregon and West Virginia spread attack offenses that might have beefed up those numbers against a little bit. But, you know, for Alabama, looking at the offense, Alabama has 228 passing yards to LSU's 183 passing yards per game, which surprised me because Jarrett Lee is the one that's having the more surprising season. But A.J. McCarron, by the numbers, has obviously thrown for more yards. And then rushing yards, Alabama has 229 per game to LSU's 189 per game. And then looking at, you mentioned the total rankings of the defense, both defensively and points against, but looking specifically at the pass and the rush, Alabama's only allowing 135 passing yards a game to LSU's 174, and only 44 rushing yards against to LSU's 76. Now, we're splitting hairs here. They're the two best defenses in the country. They're both in the top three statistically, and you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody that would disagree that they're the two best defenses in the country, if not two of the top three. So you're splitting hairs, but the hair always splits Alabama's way.
No, it is, and the thing is, even when you look at who they've played so far, I think LSU has the best win with that game against Oregon. But after that, Alabama has the next best win with the win over Arkansas, which is close.
Yeah.
And they have a win, obviously, against Penn State that looks better by the day. Now, we can dispute how we feel about Penn State, but it still looks like the next best win. I mean, when you look at LSU, they beat West Virginia, but part of the reason those statistics are a little bit tough for them in the passing game is in that game, Geno Smith threw for 463 yards at LSU. You take those 463 yards out of it, and it makes a pretty big difference. But yeah, you know, Alabama across the board, they say, you know, their defensive line might not be as athletic, as fast, but it's bigger, and the athleticism isn't far enough away that when you consider what Alabama has done along their defensive line, and certainly in the secondary, it's hard to find a huge edge, but the edge always does lean a little bit towards Alabama, and I think that's a story that we're going to find throughout going over this game. Yeah. But, you know, that's the kind of game it might be.
Yeah, we'll get into the meat and potatoes of the matchup a little bit more, get away from the numbers a little bit, but the one thing that I do have to say that LSU holds the advantage in is turnovers. LSU with the plus 15 turnover rating to Alabama's plus 6. LSU has forced 18 turnovers. Like you said, they've got a ton of interceptions. They've got 11 interceptions. They've got 7 fumble recoveries to Alabama's 5 fumble recoveries and 9 interceptions. But more importantly, LSU has only turned the ball over 3 times all year. They've lost 2 fumbles, and they've only thrown 1 interception, which if you would have told me that LSU would have only thrown 1 interception all year, I would have been a bit surprised by that, considering what we thought they were in the passing game coming into the year. Alabama has thrown 5 interceptions and lost 3 fumbles, so they've got 8 turnovers, and they've only forced 14 to LSU's 18-3 ratio, so in a game like this, that's going to be decided by very few points, that's going to be a defensive game, turnovers are going to be a big deal. The team that wins the turnover battle is going to have a massive edge, yep. And that's one major stat that LSU has held the edge in to this point.
Yeah, and the other one being, if you wanted to look for another edge, I would argue special teams is an LSU's
favorite. That's a great point, too.
And in a game like this, I mean, special teams is always huge. Even in games in this series in the past, it's proven huge. And LSU, they're probably the best punting team in the country. They have an unbelievable punter who always seems to pin it inside the 20 and give them great field position. But they also have electrifying return men, and as we know with Les Miles, he's never afraid to fake a punt or a field goal in the most creative ways possible. And in a game like this, I'm sure Nick Saban will prepare for that, but you have to look at that as another area where they could have an edge. But I mean, for me, the thing that I immediately pointed to with this game that I can't wait to see how it plays out, how is the offensive coordinator Jim McElwain going to scheme against LSU's defensive coordinator John Chavis? Because if I'm John Chavis, the first thing I'm going to do is say, I'm putting 9 in the box.
Yeah.
I am going to take Trent Richardson away. Yeah, you might be bigger than us on the offensive line, but if we bring 9 guys, the extra numbers with a defense like ours, believe me, we will hold
Trent
Richardson.
And with all the athleticism on that defense,
they're going to feel confident that if they can bring 9, that they can stop Trent Richardson. The question is, will A.J. McCarron allow them to bring 9 on a consistent basis? Because I want to know if A.J. McCarron can beat this team with his arm. I'm not convinced yet that we've seen McCarron tested to the degree, even at home, that he's going to have to be in this game, and he's completing 67% of his passes, 10 touchdowns, 3 interceptions, but he hasn't been asked to do a whole lot. I think he's going to be asked to do more in this game than he has at any point in the season, and how will he respond?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question, both quarterbacks, but, you know, Trent Richardson is indisputably the best offensive player on the field. So the game plan has to be to stop him. But, you know, you stuff 9 guys in the box, you are leaving that passing game vulnerable.
And this is why, so the key to the game, to me, is when you think about Alabama, the first thing you probably think about is Nick Saban, right? The second thing you'd probably think about is Trent Richardson, and then maybe you'd think about the defense, a guy like Dante Hightower, maybe even the offensive line. How far down the list of thoughts that you have about Alabama do you have to get before you think about Marquise Mays and Darius Hanks? Because my argument would be those names are not near the top of your list of people you think about in Alabama. They need to be this week, because those guys are going to be one-on-one. They're probably going to be matched up against guys like Morris Claiborne and Tyrann Mathieu, some of the best in the country, if not the best in the country. How are they going to do in that matchup? Because the way Alabama's offense works, it's a pro-style, play-action offense. You're going to have not that many receivers on the field, 2, maybe 3. Those guys are going to have to win their one-on-ones, can they?
You know Tyrann Mathieu is not going to lose a one-on-one to virtually anyone in the country. So that's the thing. If you're stopping the run with 9 guys and Tyrann Mathieu is shutting down whoever he's going to be covering, where are McCarron's options going to be in this one?
Yeah, and you know, the flip side, obviously, is that as good as Jarrett Lee has been, and he, again, has a great touchdown-to-interception ratio, I'm curious as to how Alabama is going to deal with the 2 quarterback system, and maybe even how is LSU going to deal with it? Because will they get their 2 quarterbacks out of rhythm? What if they're both going 3 and out a lot? You know, how are you going to manage when to put Jefferson in, when to run designed runs, when to take Lee and try to take shots down the field? I actually think that LSU has the better playmakers on the outside as another advantage. I love Reuben Randall. I like Russell Shepard. I think they're flat out better than anything Alabama has on their
in the wide receiving core, no question. Yeah,
I mean, Reuben Randall's a legitimate 6'4 physical target that, as good as some of those secondary players are for Alabama, he can win those one-on-one matchups. But
if he commands commands double coverage, can the rest of that wide receiver core do enough?
I at least think you have guys behind him and Beckham and a guy like Russell Shepard that are capable of making plays in a way that they've shown they can in the past. I just wonder, will LSU be able to run the ball? I mean, clearly that stat about Alabama only allowing 100-yard rusher in the last 55 games.
Yeah, and only 44 yards a game.
They don't need to get to they don't need a 100-yard rusher in this game, but what they need is they need to stay balanced enough to keep the defense honest so that they can still take shots down the field, because LSU is going to have to win, I think, both of these teams have to play with balance. But LSU has to be able to do what they've done in the past, like we saw last week, where both Lee and Jefferson bombed that ball out. They need to be able to take shots down the field, and Alabama's not going to let them do that if they're able to key in on a guy like Reuben Randall.
Yeah, the problem is I have enough respect for Trent Richardson to believe that even if LSU is making stopping the run their number one priority, Trent Richardson can still find a way to not rush for 120 yards and two touchdowns like he would against a lesser team, but to rush for 80 yards, maybe break a 15-20 yarder that gets you into that range to get a touchdown. I don't see it out of Spencer Ware. I don't see it out of the LSU running game against this Alabama defense. I don't see the running game being out. Now, on the flip side, I can see LSU making the plays in the passing game that maybe Alabama can't.
And that's the key, yeah.
But on the road, we have to talk about the fact that this game is in Alabama. You know, the atmosphere in this game is everything. And, you know, Jarrett Lee and Jordan Jefferson, they both played great this year. But this atmosphere is going to be totally different. And you're right, both teams are going to have a balanced attack. But I believe that Alabama can get away with running the ball more than LSU can. So LSU, I think, is going to have to pass the ball more. And yeah, if they can pull it off, they win the game, but I think that's where it spells disaster for LSU.
Yeah, and you know, LSU, the way they won this game in the past, you know, last year included, is Trent Richardson's had 600-yard games, he has 17 touchdowns, but in this matchup, he ran for 28 yards on 6 carries last year. He got banged up 2 years ago as a healthy freshman, 27 yards on 6 carries. So LSU has seen this guy before. Now, he hasn't been the featured back that he will be now, but I do believe LSU can stop him. I believe they can hold him under 100 yards. The question is, In doing that, do they commit way too much and give McCarron some confidence, because he's going to have more space than he's ever had probably in his career, because LSU is going to do everything they can to stop Trent Richardson. And if they get passes early, that's going to scare LSU and probably back them off, and then Trent Richardson will have room.
Right. I don't love AJ McCarron, but if the question is, can he take advantage of a defense that's not giving him any respect at all at home? Yeah, I think he can.
Yeah, and I mean, here's the thing. I mean, LSU, as we've said, they're number 2 in the nation behind Oklahoma State in turnover margin. So that's a great stat for them. Alabama, you know, they're at 0.75 as far as a turnover ratio. Still solid, but not nearly the degree that LSU is. They've got on the road. LSU has got to make that continue to trend their way, or else it's going to be a long day. And again, I'm looking for reasons to like LSU in this game, and there actually are a few. But here's the one thing that I have to say about LSU that worries me a little bit. In their history, since 1958, they haven't gone undefeated in a season, which is stunning. I mean, if you think about LSU, even under Nick Saban, I mean, the Nick Saban years were great for LSU. They haven't gone undefeated since 1958. And while the program's been unbelievable under Les Miles, they've had more bizarre finishes, more wacky moments, more crazy things. LSU has never lost fewer than 2 games under Les Miles. Even the year they won the national championship, they lose 2 games at least every year. So if you're looking for a loss, there's undoubtedly the feeling that this would be it, and it might even result in another 2-loss season. I don't know if I can trust a team that has gone this long without being able to finish a season with an undefeated record or even a 1-loss record.
Yeah, it's hard when you're looking at trends like we've talked about, because you know, those are past teams, mm-hmm. and you can't fault past teams for you know what these current teams are doing. It's hard to imagine LSU getting to two losses this season, but it's not hard to imagine them getting to one, obviously, here. And, you know, we can talk about the future prospects of these teams a bit later, but assuming LSU wins this game, they could still slip up against Arkansas. That's always a tough game for them.
They lost three or four to Arkansas.
Right. So we could see that. But you know, last year LSU beat Alabama, and Alabama was a 7-point road favorite in that one, and LSU pulled it off. But I think that Alabama team didn't necessarily hold a candle to this one, despite the fact that statistically their defense ended up you know, in the top five in the nation. This is a much more polished Alabama team, arguably an even better defense than their 2009 team. I've heard a couple people arguing that, and you could certainly argue that. Home field is everything in this game, and I honestly think that's the deciding factor. I mean, Alabama, from the spread perspective, is a 4.5-point favorite in this game. I think that has a lot to do with home field advantage. I think it also has to do with the statistics that we were talking about. But, you know, I don't know that they're going to win it by 4.5, but I do think they end up winning it because they make a few more plays on offense and because they have that home field advantage.
Yeah, in a game of elite players all over the field, it just seems like Alabama's are slightly better, slightly more.
That's how I feel, yeah.
If you look at it by the calculations of a lot of draft scouts and things, Alabama is going to field about 15 players who will end up getting drafted, four who are probably going to be taken as the first player at their position. Obviously, Trent Richardson, a corner like Drake Kirkpatrick will probably go number one in his, safety Mark Barron will probably go number one in his, and then you have an outside linebacker like Courtney Upshaw, and that doesn't even include, you know, a guy like Dante Hightower. It's amazing what these guys are going to be able to do probably at the next level and what they already are. But maybe even more frightening is scouts also say that all 11 of LSU's defensive starters are going to be pros at some point. I just think, though, that when you look at it, and that's an amazing stat to think about, but when you look at it, it just seems like Alabama's players are a little bit, they're going to be the guys that are more elite in the pros. LSU will all get to the pros, but Alabama has the game changers that you're looking for on the field. The only guy I concern myself with, again, is AJ McCarron, because he's had some accuracy trouble when he goes down the field. They don't ask him to do it that much. A lot of those yards are after the catch that they have. So will he be able to get enough room in a ball-hawking secondary with two legitimate NFL starting corners? Will they be able to get that? Other than that, it seems like an Alabama win here, but I don't know by how much.
Yeah, because say what you want about Jarrett Lee and Jordan Jefferson, but they have experience. Yeah. They've played in tough games before. Yeah. AJ McCarron, this is the biggest game of his career, obviously, and all it takes is one mistake. In a game like this, it only takes one mistake. But I want to ask you this, since you're more of the personnel guy than I am. Obviously, you can't go wrong with any of these players on either side of the ball, as you just pointed out. But we talked a couple podcasts ago about the importance of the defensive line, mm-hmm. and in the SEC especially, how teams have driven their defensive line all the way to the championship year in and year out. Which team is going to win the battle of the lines in this game?
It's funny. I like LSU's defensive line better in terms of pure athleticism. I don't know that that's going to help them in this game, because it was on full display against Oregon. If you want to see what the best defensive line athletically in the country looks like, put on that game film.
And that was, I think you're getting ready to say that was the perfect matchup for that defensive
perfect.
Line, an athletic offensive line that really didn't have the athletes.
They were
had
like
the
salivating at that kind of offense, because you know, with no disrespect to Oregon, they weren't afraid of LaMichael James or Darren Thomas at all. It was right playing in right to their hand. This is a whole other monster. Alabama prides itself on how physical and big they are in the offensive line, and they go downhill. And if there's one weakness, it might be hitting LSU directly in the mouth, because they are a little bit undersized. But you know, on the other side of the ball, Alabama's defensive line is not that much worse in terms of athleticism, and they're bigger, and they are space eaters. All they do is eat space and plug up the holes. I don't think there's going to be any room for Spencer Ware to run, who is a downhill runner, and there's going to be no, you know, he's not going to get outside on this defense, but there's not going to be any room up the middle either. Maybe Ford can get a little bit of outside room, but honestly, their only chance, I don't think, is to go with very much. They got to keep them honest with the run, but it's those vertical Reuben Randall routes that they just have to win against very good corners. Otherwise, like, I like Alabama's defensive line because they are the perfect mix of size and athleticism.
Yeah, because hearing you talk about it, I mean, that's kind of the vibe I got from this game, and that's why I have to lean Alabama, because, like I said, Trent Richardson isn't going to have a huge day. Right. If he has a huge day, that would be a stunner. Oh, no question. The Heisman's done. I mean, sorry, Andrew, yeah. But it's all his if he has a huge day. But with this offensive line pushing a very athletic defensive line around, LSU is going to need support in the running game. Alabama's defensive line might not need a whole lot of support, so you can get back, pin your ears back for that big passing game, which is likely to come, and that would fall right into Alabama's hands. That's kind of how it sounds like we both see it going. Do you think home field is a big deal
Definitely.
Here?
Definitely. I mean, I think that, you know, somebody was writing an article about Bryant-Denny Stadium and how much it's evolved. It wasn't that highly thought of not that long ago as far as a home field advantage. Alabama's a storied program. They've always had a great home field advantage, but not the monster advantage that you see even LSU have in Death Valley. Now, they've made so many advancements that the noise level in that stadium is unbelievable, and they are obviously going to be more juiced now than they've ever been. So I think that Alabama's going to feed off of that, especially in the running game, and it might even help Trent Richardson push that 75-yard mark, maybe pushing towards 100, which could be enough to do what they need out of this. That's what you look for out of your home field. Give you the extra push, the extra boost, maybe make LSU a little more tired, and it could be a difference in this game.
Yeah, I think LSU's strength is outlasting teams and getting into that second half where they can really start to push teams around, yeah, and their conditioning and athleticism comes out. But it's not going to happen in this game against, yeah, Alabama, because they're built the same way. So all four quarters, you have to figure both teams are going to be playing their best. And, you know, it could so easily go either way. A couple trends, since we were talking a bit about trends earlier, that I want to bring up here. LSU is 7-3 straight up in their last 10 games against Alabama. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we have to factor in that Alabama is a much different team now than they were through a lot of those losses. Over the last four games, it's been split 2-2. But I do think it's interesting, speaking of Alabama's home field advantage, that Alabama has lost four of the last five games they've played against LSU in their home stadium. Yeah. Now, they won the last one, but they lost the four previous ones. Funny thing about that stat, of course, two of those four losses came with Nick Saban on the other side of the sidelines on at LSU. So yeah, you could argue that Nick Saban always wins in this stadium, regardless of who he's coaching.
No, so that's it. And again, that's what's so stunning. As many great teams as LSU has had, the fact that they haven't been able to go undefeated in one of these years, and really their glory years these days, in this decade, is surprising. But no, that matchup has been very good to them lately. And I know Alabama is aware of that, and I think that they believe this is the best team they've had in a while, especially defensively, even with that 09 team, as you said. So if it's going to happen, I think this is the year that they really start to assert themselves in this matchup. But, you know, for me, it's just one of those scores where I could totally see it being like a 20-16 type of game with Alabama on top. It just looks like it's going to be a classic. I love defensive football, so, it's not going to bother me that we don't have the shootout like we did against USC and Stanford. But what are you thinking as far as a score?
Well, I have to say, from a gambling perspective, Ian, because that's kind of what got me into college football, just the fascination of trying to pick games against the spread and whatnot. 4.5 seems like a pretty good spread to me, because as much as I immediately lean LSU plus 4.5, because to me, this has to be a game that ends by 3 or 4 points, doesn't it? I mean, the way these two teams are built, it strikes me. The score I keep going back to in my head is 17-14 Alabama. That's just kind of what, if you ask me about a score, that's what jumps out to me. But look at the last five games that these two teams have played. Last year was the field goal game, LSU beaten by a field goal. But the year before, Alabama wins by 9. Year before that, they win by 6. Year before that, LSU wins by 7, 41-34. That was an offensive showdown in Saban's first year with Alabama. And the year before that, LSU won by 14. So four of the last five games between these two teams have been decided by 6 points or more. So that's interesting. Another interesting thing, because of those margins and because of the fact that these teams have actually found a way to score, four of the last five games have gone over the total. And here's a game that I would think with these two defenses, I should go with the under. Last year it was a push, so the over is 4-0-1 in this game. Pretty crazy. You're thinking 17-14, but you know, you look at these two teams offensively, mm-hmm. and you don't see a whole lot that you love by the yardage numbers, but there's a reason why Alabama is ranked 12th, yep. and LSU is ranked 13th, and like you said, by the most minuscule of percentages, that they both average just over 39 points a game. It comes down to special teams, it comes down to turnovers, it comes down to these big plays that they make. And you're not expecting that in a game like this, but you just never know.
Yeah, and again, Alabama is the best offense statistically in the SEC, which surprised even me. I thought maybe Arkansas would be there. But the thing about them, they're so balanced. That they run for 229 yards a game, and they pass for 228. So when you're really looking for what is the little difference going to be, that ability to stay balanced, if they can do it in this game, could be the reason that they just squeak out on top. But again, it's one of those games that I just hope that it is one of those 3 or 4 point thrillers, because it would be surprising and disappointing to see like somehow a 10 or 13 point win by one of these teams.
Yeah, I could see a 20-10 type right. of game where maybe it is 13-10 throughout most of the game and then one team pulls away late. But that's what I was kind of saying when we were starting talking about this game. What does this game have to do to live up to these expectations? Does it have to go into multiple overtimes? Right. Is just a field goal to win it in the waning seconds enough?
I mean, if we compare it to the two games we've seen lately, I mean, you know, we want that entertainment value of overtimes or Hail Mary passes.
Right, and we know it's going to be a different type of entertainment right. because it's a defensive football game, which those two clearly weren't. Yep. So I think we'd be happy with a 14-10 type of game, because that's what we're looking for out of these two teams. But will that satisfy us? That's yet to be seen. Before we wrap this up, I just kind of want to ask you your thoughts on what people are saying about, you know, obviously these are the two best teams in the country. I can't imagine anybody at this point would think otherwise. You could have made an argument for Oklahoma before they lost that game. Love what Oklahoma State is doing, but it's not really debatable as much as we love Stanford, too. These are the two best teams in the nation. They're going to decide it on the football field. And some people say if this game is as close as we anticipate it being, that a rematch of this game should happen in the national championship yeah. game. What's your feelings about that?
A lot of people I really respect have said absolutely not, which came out as a surprise to me.
I've read the same.
You know, one of those things where it's like if a team doesn't win their side of a conference, even you know they finish second in their own division, much less in the conference, much less in the entire picture, then they shouldn't be playing for a national championship. I get that. I understand that. And actually, I certainly beat that drum when Michigan and Ohio State had this situation go on a few years ago. And I'm glad I did, because the Florida game, I'm glad a lot of people did, because that Florida team ended up demolishing Ohio State. But there's something about this one that if it was like a 1 point game that came down to the fourth, some 1 minute left and a team kicks a field goal to win it, I don't know if I could look at a situation where I kept them out, assuming that Stanford or Oklahoma State found a way to lose. And then you had a Boise State team that was undefeated. I mean, a one loss team, I understand the argument about that. And certainly, you know, if Boise State was undefeated, and maybe even if one other team was, I'd take a serious look. But if both Oklahoma State and Stanford are undefeated, and you're going to vault an Alabama or an LSU over both of them, that would be hard for me, because I have too much respect for the Big 12 and the Pac-12 and those teams as they're currently structured to say you're not good enough to play in a game over a one-loss team that's second in their own division.
Yeah, I agree 100% with what you just said, and I also agree with what some of these people that you're talking about have said, that if we only get one national championship, well, you know, a lot of us want a playoff, obviously. We want to see all these things shake out the right way. But if we're only going to get one game, why do we want to see a rematch? Why don't we want to see the winner of this game go up against a Stanford yeah. or an Oklahoma State or even a Boise State, just to see a new game, to see a new storyline play out on the field? It's funny. I'm glad you brought up that people were saying that whole, if you finish second in your division or you're second in your conference, that you don't deserve to be in there. That doesn't make any sense to me logically. And I know you weren't saying yeah. that, but I'm saying if the two best teams in the world are in the same division, yeah. and the rest of the world sucks, that doesn't mean that those aren't the 1 and 2 teams. That it's funny because I've heard at least 3 or 4 different sports reporters use that exact terminology. If you can't win your own conference, you don't belong in the championship game. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. There are plenty of more logical ways to go about saying you don't want to see a rematch than that one, in my opinion.
I think both of us, this is a lot more for us about respect for Stanford and Oklahoma State than it is talking about divisions or conferences. I mean, right now the SEC West has 3 of the top 7 teams in the country. So what in the world do we need to say other than forget the division? That's just a great set of football teams.
Right.
You know, it's more that we're talking about, for, you know, division conference aside, Oklahoma State and Stanford deserve to be taken as serious threats if they're undefeated. They deserve to find their way into a game like that. And if they're not undefeated, I would certainly look back at the argument of putting teams in the same division into a rematch. I just think that there are teams out there that are undefeated that need a serious look.
Well, there's no question, and I would be really disappointed, you know, and I think it would just really be an SEC bias to argue that a rematch is deserved over an undefeated Oklahoma State or an undefeated Stanford. Because like you said, you can't ask a team in a respected major BCS conference, a team like Stanford that's clearly built to play a game like this, or a team like Oklahoma State that has beaten ranked opponent after ranked opponent, they would obviously deserve that shot. The trickier question is Boise State. Mm-hmm. We've talked about them a bit, and they could, if Stanford and Oklahoma State lose, which is not out of the question at all, right. Stanford has Oregon, and they showed some weaknesses on defense in that USC game. Oklahoma State, of course, has that Oklahoma game. An upset could happen for both of those teams. Boise State, probably not. They're probably going to go undefeated. Boise State or one-loss Alabama LSU, are you leaning towards Boise State on that one or not?
I've wanted for so long to put Boise State in a national championship game. The only issue is when you look at them compared to the loser of this game, assuming they went out, it's very hard to know what to do because, in the one hand, if you got that rematch and let's say Alabama wins this week, and then LSU finds their way back into it, and they beat Alabama in New Orleans, essentially a home game. What have you solved? Who's the real national champion?
Right, we need a rubber game.
You gotta have a rubber game, don't? I mean, like, again, I know they would be the national champions, right. LSU would, but it's one of those things where in the heart of all of us, we would say, well, who really is the best? We need it in a neutral field. I know that's not a reason to put Boise in the game,
right.
But it's kind of crazy to think about the fact that LSU, if they got back into it with a loss, would have home field, so you'd have two dueling home field games. It'd be a kind of a nutty scenario to think about.
I would lean Boise State strictly because this game is being decided on the field. Yes, it's in Alabama, but this game is being decided on the field. We can call this the national championship. Right. That's fine with me. I'm fine with calling this game the national championship, and then that game on January 9th, we can call a really great game between two great football teams. If that's how people want to rationalize it, that's fine, but I would probably rather see a rematch from a skill perspective. I think whoever loses this game is obviously a better team than Boise State, but I'd rather see an undefeated Boise State get rewarded, assuming, obviously, they were the only undefeated team left, other than maybe Houston. But the last question on kind of those hypotheticals, Boise State finds a way to lose, too, and everybody's got one loss. Yeah. Then do you definitely go with the rematch, or do you think about a team like an Oregon?
What about a team like Oklahoma, who right now is in the best position to do it? I mean,
great point, because then they would jump Oklahoma State, obviously.
Yep. They're in the driver's seat right now, if you think about it.
That's a great point.
They could jump everybody.
Because if Stanford loses, they have to drop, and then, they would jump Oklahoma State with the win. Boise State with the loss would fall into the bottom. They'd fall out of the top 10.
I mean, it'd be so interesting to see, what do you do if Oklahoma wins out, and you have Oklahoma and a one-loss LSU? What do you do there? I mean, do you reward a team like Oklahoma that started as the number one team and worked their way back potentially into being in that discussion? Or do you go rematch at that point? It's kind of a scenario that the BCS, again, would have a nightmare solving, so maybe part of me wants to see it happen. But I have seen people that are still very confident that Oklahoma will be in the national championship game. And I didn't think about it until today. But if you really look at it, that's still a scenario that could happen in an instant. If some of these things unfold.
That's interesting. So we were just talking about what about a one-loss SEC team, but what about a one-loss Oklahoma team? And they would probably be more likely to go with that over a rematch because of the storm that would be created if they did have a rematch.
And if we believe the Big 12 is the second best conference,
which we do, we have to,
and they win it. Mm-hmm. Then maybe they would be back in it. You know, I mean, it's just one of those things where who would have thought that we'd already discussed them again. But the winner of the Big 12, if it's a one-loss team and it happens to be Oklahoma, they might be back in that game. So, you know, so many scenarios and a lot, obviously, that we'll figure out here in the next few weeks.
Yeah, hopefully we get to keep seeing them play out. Right. You know, I mean, if Oklahoma State runs the table, they're in.
Yeah.
That's about the only thing we know at this point. Short of that, anything can happen. So we'll see what happens in this one. I guess we're both going with Alabama, but certainly not as confidently as we've picked against some of these teams in the past. I mean, LSU wouldn't be a major upset. They're the number one team in the country for a reason.
Yeah, not at all. LSU has everything they need to win this game. We'll see what happens.
Well, if anybody's still listening, we'd like to thank you. We just kind of said, you know what? We weren't going to have this conversation off the air. We said we're going to save the Alabama-LSU conversation for on the air, and we just had it. That's how we were going to have it over dinner, so if you don't like it, I'm sorry.
We liked it.
We liked it. We had a good time. If you're still here, you must have at least tolerated it, so thank you for that. We're going to go into our quick hits. Sometimes our quick hits aren't so quick. They're a good 20 minutes or so. Probably not this week. We'll keep them pretty short for you. We'll start with our biggest surprise, as always. My biggest surprise, and I always seem to find a way to talk about UCLA, but my biggest surprise is that UCLA could actually find their way into bowl eligibility. Now, last week they had the 31-14 win over Cal, just a convincing, strong win over Cal. And I was looking at it on my computer, and then they put it up on the TV. UCLA, if you look at their losses, it's a pretty respectable bunch of losses for them. They lose to Houston, who's undefeated. They lose to Texas, who's ranked. They lose to Stanford, who's one of the best teams in the country. Then they have that terrible game against Arizona, hard to make excuses for. But Arizona has one of the best passing games in the nation, so it's a respectable batch of losses. Now, granted, this far into Rick Neuheisel's tenure, they need to be winning games like that. You can't just keep saying, oh, they're okay losses. But you can make an excuse for most of those losses. They get Arizona State this week, a team that they perennially play well against. I don't think they're going to beat Arizona State. I think that's one of these teams we were just talking about that's out of their comfort zone. But they go into Utah the following week. I think that's the game that could be their bowl season, because that's a game they could win. If they play the way they played against Cal and they run the ball well, they could win that game. Then they come home and play Colorado, a game that they will win. That would get them to 6 wins. Might not be enough to save Rick Neuheisel's job, or I don't even know if they'd get a bowl invite, but they could get to bowl eligibility if they beat Arizona State at home or Utah on the road, and it's a surprise to me that that actually could happen, because I was writing this team off as a 3-win type of team. Now all of a sudden it could happen.
I mean, I certainly think they can beat Utah and Colorado, and what's really scary to think about is if they did beat Arizona State at home this week, that could signal a 3-game winning streak, and they would not only be bowl eligible, but the Pac-12 South champion. So, you know, anything can happen for the Bruins.
Oh, man. If the Bruins win the Pac-12 South, we'll have to have a whole segment just for them.
Right. And for me, you know, the biggest surprise, I looked at Texas Tech, and we are pretty good about finding letdown games. And I think this was potentially a letdown game. Iowa State's a pretty decent team this year. So the loss surprises me, but I'm not going to say it shocks me. What does shock me is that in front of their fans in Lubbock, where they had just come off of such an emotional win, ending again Oklahoma's 39-game home winning streak, their fans had to be so excited to see them play. To put up 7 points in front of those fans with the offense that they have in a 41-7 blowout, it was a laugher. They had no energy for the game. I'm surprised that Tommy Tuberville let it happen. You know, this team was ranked 20th in the country. He's looking for an identity in his tenure. He had a great opportunity to start that identity now and get things not back to Mike Leach's style, but really, you know, Tech would be back on the map here. And to come up with that kind of letdown performance, it just was kind of frustrating, I think, for a lot of people.
What's particularly frustrating about that game for Texas Tech, you're expecting the letdown coming off of such of a massive win against Oklahoma, but a four-quarter letdown. Like you said, that's the thing that was so disappointing about that game. Okay, so you come out in the first half, and you're kind of going through the motions a little bit. You were a little too high on that Oklahoma game. But you go in at the half, you make some adjustments, and you at least have a strong second half. At least make this a respectable loss, if not a come-from-behind victory. And the second half was just as pitiful as the first. They just didn't have anything for a full 60 minutes. Wouldn't expect that at all from a team that just beat Oklahoma. How is it even possible to only score 7 points? Like you said, Iowa State's a decent team, but very disappointing. That was a big surprise.
Yeah, no, and so moving on to upset alert, and I'm going to stick with the same team. Texas Tech now goes into Texas a week later, obviously after a classic letdown. I think Tech might actually be able to bounce back and play with some energy on the road. Seth Dagey, the quarterback, who's been pretty great all year, over 2,700 yards passing, 22 touchdowns and 6 picks, didn't have a touchdown last week, threw 2 picks, had a terrible game. He's too good to have 2 games like that in a row, even against a good Texas defense. I think the offense might be able to channel its game from a couple of weeks ago, and if they do get this one, they're bowl eligible at 6-3, and right back feeling good. I mean, 43-0, Texas beat Kansas, but in that win, David Ash, who's been the quarterback and taken the snaps as of late for Texas, he's only thrown 3 touchdowns and has 5 interceptions on the year. He's not a proven commodity, and so if Texas Tech can, again, channel what they did a couple of weeks ago against Oklahoma, maybe they get it done this week.
Yeah, and putting up 43 points on Kansas is like putting up 14 points on any other team in the nation. I mean, it's not an impressive win against Kansas, so absolutely, Tech could win that game. Which Tech team will show up? That's, I mean, it could be a vintage yo-yo type of team if they keep playing like this. My upset alert, and it's not a huge upset alert, but Stanford going into Oregon State. Oregon State is a 21-point underdog here. Stanford, they just won their previous 10 or so games by 25-plus, so you would obviously expect them to get back to that against Oregon State here, but you don't get much more of a sandwich game effect than this game right here. You're coming off of an insane USC game. Next week, you have the Oregon game, which is the season for Stanford. So you're coming off of a huge game, and you've got a huge game coming up. It's easy to overlook a game like Oregon State, that with the way they're playing this year, it's no big deal. But Corvallis has been a tricky place for teams in the past. Just ask USC, just ask some of those Oregon teams. It's been a tough place to play in the past. This Oregon State team isn't as good as those teams of those previous years, but it's a tricky place. And even that Arizona game, that's not even close. Obviously, Stanford's a much better team than Arizona. But Oregon State put it all together in that game and stopped a very strong offense in that game. I mean, they held them 27, and a lot of those points were in garbage time late. So it's not going to happen, but it's a game that Stanford just kind of needs to be careful in, because if they are feeling high about USC through Wednesday and then thinking about Oregon through Saturday, they could get caught in this one. Yeah, I don't think they will, but who knows?
Obviously a bold call, but I think it would be nice if Stanford listened to running the option this week, because I think they do need to at least be wary of that area. This time of year can be brutal weather-wise. I don't know how the forecast will look, but it's not a great place to play this time of year. And for a team that is coming off of what I think is a significant injury with Zach Ertz being on the shelf, I just want to see how they run their offense, especially their run game, because it's going to be interesting to see if they come with those really huge power formations with 3 tight ends when they've lost one of their most kind of diverse and solid tight ends in there.
Yeah, the thing about this game, I mean, even if Stanford does come out slow, you can't imagine Oregon State building up enough of a lead that Stanford couldn't overcome it and win. So Stanford should win this one, but could be closer than it appears. And moving into the game I'm looking forward to, Kansas State, Oklahoma State. Now, this looks like, after what we just saw from Kansas State getting blown out by Oklahoma last week, this looks like a game that Oklahoma State should just roll to another multi-touchdown victory. They are a 21-point favorite. But last week, we said that Kansas State was just a perfect fit for Oklahoma's defense, because all they do is run the ball. They don't pass particularly well, and Oklahoma can defend against the run. And so we kind of knew that was going to be the case. In this one, I'm not so sure, because we've just talked about Oklahoma State forcing those turnovers, but Kansas State's a smart team that tends not to turn the ball over that much. And I think they can run and play the offense the way they like to play it against this Oklahoma State defense, and they might be able to turn those drives into scores instead of turnovers. This game could be a shootout. And I think this could be a dangerous spot for Oklahoma State, that a lot of people are all of a sudden just writing Kansas State off as a total joke after what happened last week. I don't think so. I really think this could be a very good game. And again, I think Oklahoma State has the firepower and has the big play potential that they will win this one. But I'm looking forward to it because I think it could be one of the sleeper games of the week.
Yeah, I mean, this is a game where Colin Klein, the quarterback at K-State, will have a lot more room to operate what he likes to do. There's not going to be, the gaps aren't going to be plugged to the degree that they were last week. So in that way, when you talk about keeping the ball and time of possession and running your offense, that could really work towards their advantage. There will be yards to gain against Oklahoma State, and they have a good enough offense that if they can do it the way they do it, and get that defense hopefully focused again, because that's the key. Can they at least make enough plays to stay in a shootout with Oklahoma
State? Right, that's the question.
They obviously got a humbling lesson last week. But I do think that, yeah, that this is a game that if Oklahoma State's not 100% focused and they're still laughing about Kansas State's score last week, you know, look out, because they're in no position where they're going to take everyone's best shot. They're now the guys that everybody wants
to knock off.
They've
got the target on their back, no question.
So for me, you know, it's South Carolina going into Arkansas. This is a series that Arkansas has played well in over the last few years.
Two top 10 teams in the SEC getting completely ignored this week with the LSU-Alabama game.
It really is. They are 9-7? And here's the thing. This is an opportunity for one of those teams to settle in squarely to the third spot in the pecking order in the SEC, albeit coming out of two separate divisions, but they'd be that third team to keep an eye on in a year where I honestly think the SEC is down.
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah. LSU and Alabama are masking what has otherwise been a terrible year talent-wise and in all other ways for the SEC. They can't keep their talent on the field. Teams are losing in weird ways.
Even Georgia, who we were just upselling, look at the teams they've beaten. I mean, there's just nothing there.
No, there really isn't. We wouldn't know it because of how good the two teams on top of them. But South Carolina has really stuttered on offense since Lattimore went down. They've scored 14 points in each of their last two games, but the defense has been that good, as we knew that front seven could be, and they've won games for them. So it's a classic offense-defense showdown. Arkansas with Tyler Wilson, he's leading the SEC in passing. I'm sure that that this game will be emphasized from Spurrier to keep the passing game and at a minimum and make Arkansas run a little bit. But I look at this and I want to say South Carolina has got a shot. The only thing that keeps me wondering is, I think 14 points isn't even going to be close to doing it on the road against Arkansas. Can they at least get to 28 points or something?
Right, probably not.
Because I just don't know if they can. I want to believe that Connor Shaw, the new running back, Brandon Wilds, who's carried the load pretty well, and Alshon Jeffrey, I just don't know. Even though Arkansas struggled with Vanderbilt and Ole Miss, they might get back on track this week.
Yeah, but that's the case you can make for South Carolina, that Arkansas has, over the last 2 weeks, against inferior opponents, struggled.
Yeah.
And they let Ole Miss get out to that big lead early, and they let Texas A&M get out to that. Now, those are better offenses than what South Carolina has right now. But if South Carolina gets out to a double-digit lead, they don't give it up.
Yeah.
This defense, I don't think, gives it up, even in Arkansas.
Yeah.
So are they capable of getting out to a double-digit lead? Probably not.
Right.
But that's another game that could go South Carolina's way. Would be crazy if it did. And would give them a great shot in the arm in the East, obviously.
Yep.
But if Arkansas wins that one, just a tough time to be behind LSU
and the thing about Arkansas, no one else outside of the state will believe it, but they think they can beat LSU in any given year. Again, they've won three of the last four in that series.
I believe it.
So they certainly, even going into LSU, it's a rivalry game, the battle for the boot. I'm sure they feel like they can steal one, and then wouldn't that change the landscape a lot?
Absolutely, it would. This has been the longest episode of Running the Option ever, episode 9. I am Dave Consolazio alongside Sam Sag. As always, you can email me at vegasdavesdime@gmail.com.
And you can email me at samsag@gmail.com.
If you have any questions or comments, thank you guys so much for listening and sticking around. I hope to have you back next week.
Take care, everybody.